thank you, and thank you very much for the invitation to be here. I'm the Western Regional Coordinator of the ANSWER Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. I'm based in San Francisco. And I speak on behalf of the organization, write fairly frequently. I've been to the Middle East a number of times. Most recently, I was to Syria almost a year ago now, last December. But I've traveled also to Palestine. I've been to Iraq a couple times during the sanctions in the 1990s with Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, who made that a very big issue. And I think that it's interesting to see right now that we are perhaps at a decisive moment in the Middle East. A sea change is taking place in the region and in regard to U.S. policy in the region. And I want to talk tonight some about that related to the election and to the anti-war movement. I hope that we have a lot of time for a discussion and people will make their comments and questions and so forth. I was just reminded by Kez that the filming is taking place of the movie, The Battle of Seattle, right now in Seattle. And I had the good fortune to be here at that time. And I was here for a while because I was actually working on two different things. I was working on that, but also it seemed at the time that Fidel Castro was going to come to Seattle. I don't know if people remember that, but the U.S. had to let him in. They couldn't keep him out because of the World Trade Organization. The Cubans, I think, decided from the point of view of security that that was too dangerous. And given all the assassination attempts, that's pretty understandable. And the foreign minister ended up coming. So I was working on the event where he spoke, Felipe Perez Roque. But I will always remember that on November 29th, I think it was the PI had an article. And in the article, it said that Clinton was happy about the demonstrations that were going to take place because he felt those demonstrations were going to support his point of view, his administration's point of view in the talks that took place. That was on November 29th. I think he was a lot less happy on the 30th. And in fact, that was what happened here on November 30th was also a turning point. It really kind of broke through what had existed for about 10 years or maybe more in the movement in the United States, which was really all of this triumphalism. You all remember it, or I think most of you do, of the right wing, that it was the end of history. And you remember the guy who said that, he took it back after Seattle. He did. I mean, really, he said, oh, it wasn't really the end of history. The end of history, meaning that the system that exists now is the highest that that humans can aspire to. You know, I mean, that's really what the end of history meant. That's it. We've reached the end of change. And, of course, that's not an unusual idea. Every empire that has ever existed thinks it's eternal and it will always exist and it will always be number one. And, you know, that's not a new idea. It's actually, you know, a part of the official foreign policy of the United States today. It's called the National Security Strategy, which probably many of you are aware of. If you're not, you can go look, you know, you can go Google National Security Strategy 2002 and read it, where it says no country should be allowed to rise to compete with the United States. And probably this is what the Assyrians thought too, you know, and the Romans and the Greeks and the British. But that idea was really broken to a large degree. A new movement came into being, really, was kind of flowed from what happened here in Seattle on November 30th and the days that followed. So now we have just gone through the much-anticipated 2006 election. I spoke at a rally that we had on October 28th. The ANSWER Coalition had rallies. We knew that they weren't going to be real big anti-war marches, but we thought it was important to go out and not just leave this whole debate over the war in Iraq and the whole policy to the politicians, none of whom were really, you know, offering, or very few of them were offering genuine alternatives to people. So we had these rallies, and we had about 2,500 people marched in San Francisco that day. And I said something like, you know, on November 7th, tens of millions of people will go to the polls hoping that in that vote that they will bring about, you know, that something will really change and that a great deal of frustration is built up. about the war more than anything, but not only about the war, but all of the policies, or many of the policies of the Bush administration. But that then on Wednesday, November 8th, everyone would get up and go to work or go to school or do what they do, and the reality will be that not much will really change. And that's the way it is with most of the elections. Is that to say that the elections are unimportant? No, it's not. Nor is it to say that November 7th was not a repudiation of the war and of the Bush administration, because it was. But the reality is, and I think it's becoming clear already, that in relation to the war, what was hoped for by people is probably not going to emanate from the election. The elections are very important. I mean, one of the things that happens in the election process, and particularly when the frustration builds up, is that the elections serve to relieve the pressure. They kind of, you know, it's a somewhat safe way. I mean, there was, and in the days afterwards, and I would say for some people who probably should have known a little bit better, in the anti-war movement, there was, in the words of Alan Greenspan, you know, the great economist, if you're very rich, he's a great economist, there was irrational exuberance, I would say. And that was certainly true in San Francisco, and I was seeing the things coming from some groups and saying, hope is restored, you know, now we can end the war. And, you know, there was a demonstration called at Nancy Pelosi's office in downtown San Francisco at the Federal Building, and the organizers suggested that people should bring banners that said, congratulations, Nancy, now let's end the war. Let's turn the House, meaning the House of Representatives, into a House of Peace, which would be something really new if it were to happen. It really was, I think, and I think even in just a few weeks, we can see that what is playing out is far, far less than what could have been hoped for. And how do we know that? Well, in the first meeting with Bush, and Nancy Pelosi met with Bush 2 days after the election, and she said going into the meeting, well, we want to put it on the – impeachment is not on the table. Impeachment's off the table. And John Conyers, who a lot of people had hoped that if he became the head of the Judiciary Committee because he has a record as a progressive, and he's from a complete – he's from probably the safest congressional district in the United States. It's like virtually all African-American, Arab-American, and, you know, he could hardly get a higher percentage of the vote. And he said, yeah, I'm with Nancy Pelosi, impeachment's off the table. So right away, you know, you take one of the things that probably the Bush administration is really quite worried about and should be quite worried about, because it really is a criminal administration. It's a criminal group. I mean, you want to talk about the impeachment of Clinton, you know, for what went on there, and compare that to, not that I'm a Clinton supporter, I marched and we organized against the war in Yugoslavia and against other, and the end of welfare as we know it and the gutting of social welfare programs. But there is, I think, on the face of it, case that Bush is guilty of more than high crimes and misdemeanors. I mean, this is a war in which hundreds of thousands of people have died now. Hundreds of thousands. The Iraqi casualties, the Lancet report done by the John Hopkins group says that as many as 655,000 Iraqis have died as a result of the invasion in 3.5 years. And that was a couple months ago, so that figure may be outdated. The U.S. combat deaths are rapidly approaching 3,000 if we're getting the real figures. And I think there's a very good possibility that we will find out later that we're not getting the real figures, or that we haven't heard the whole truth about this. But the real casualties now, according to the Iraq casualty website, if you put together how they used to count casualties, like in Vietnam, that is killed, wounded, injured, you know, those and people who are so seriously injured or ill that they have to be medevaced out of the country. As of a couple of days ago, that figure was 49,800, and now you never hear that. You never hear that. So, and the war. What's the cost of the war? I was in Cleveland last week at the U.S. Labor Against War conference, and they had a rally, and they had one of the people who spoke was Dennis Kucinich, who's from Cleveland, and Kucinich gave a figure that I had was higher than the figures we've been using or thought were the accurate figures for the cost of the war. He said that in fiscal year 2006, it was $117 billion in direct costs. This isn't taking into account the accruing costs, which he talks some about too, and others have, about, you know, what will the health care bills be down the line? What's the interest, you know, on the national debt and all that? No, just direct cost. $117 billion in fiscal year 2006 and predicted to go higher. Well, what is $117 billion? Because these figures are really too big to comprehend. It's $322 million per day. $322 million per day, about $3,700 per second. That's what's being spent. And, you know, that the real cost is now over $400 billion. It will, all the experts are predicting, be somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 trillion by the time that it's over with. So the criminality of the Bush regime is on its face. And they should be more than impeached. I mean, the whole crew should be taken to task. They should be tried for what they've done. What they've done constitute great crimes, grave crimes. But right at the beginning, no, that's off the table. The other thing that was taken off the table right at the beginning was any objection or any opposition by the Democratic Party to war appropriations for the Iraq War. And I believe it's yesterday, I got a message last night, I believe yesterday the Democratic caucus met in the House, and Kucinich objected to it. That was his point of his speech, actually, in Cleveland, was that they, you know, that's the power, and that is the power. That's the only power that really the Congress has in relation to a war would be to stop the appropriation. And they decided yesterday, no, that's off out of bounds to do that. And why is that? Well, it's partly because of the 2008 election, and they don't want to be subject to, you know, criticism for being soft on national security and so forth. But I think there's more to it than that. I think that there's the bipartisan character, which has been much heralded, of U.S. foreign policy going back to at least 1945 or 1941. And if we look at what's happened, really, and I think this is the broader picture that is a bigger picture than what, you know, might happen if there was somebody different than Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House or something. But if you look at the pattern that has developed over the last several decades, what you can see is that power, when it has to do with war and when it has to do with foreign policy, is more and more centralized in the executive branch, and that is not changing. Today is the 65th anniversary of the last time that Congress declared war. It was December 8th, 1941, 65 years ago today. There have been a few wars since then, in case no one noticed. There was the Korean War in 1950. There was the invasion of Lebanon in 1958. One day after, by the way, and not coincidentally, and something else that's left out of all of the discussion, but the day after the revolution in Iraq happened in 1958 that ended British colonial domination of that country, that dated back to the end of World War I, 40 years, the day after that revolution took place, 20,000 U.S. Marines began landing in Beirut. They went in to save the government in Lebanon, which was a pro-Western government. They also were thinking about going into Iraq, very clear. The day after that, 6,600 British Marines landed in Jordan to save the king, in the interest of democracy, of course. You know, kings are democratic when they're good kings. So they went in, and they were really thinking about this, but the revolution in Iraq at the time was too sweeping. It was a very popular revolution, and it was a sweeping revolution. It occupied the front pages of all the newspapers. It's very interesting. A few years ago, I was involved in producing a video about the real impact of the sanctions on Iraq called Genocide by Sanctions, which was a completely appropriate title. and went back and looked at the Chronicle and the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle and the New York Times from that period. And it's very interesting. The New York Times, for about a week after the Iraqi Revolution of July 14th, 1958, has no stories in the first 10 or 15 pages except about Iraq. And Eisenhower said it's the most serious crisis since the Korean War, and you could just see all the things they were thinking about. That the belief in Washington and the Eisenhower administration and in the ruling circles in the United States was that they were going to lose the whole Middle East at that time. So there was 1958, an invasion. There was the Vietnam War, of course, which began really in the late 50s. There was the 1965 invasion of the Dominican Republic. There was the 1982 invasion of Lebanon again by the U.S. Marines. And, you know, all we hear is that story about, you know, it's like the rote history that's presented to us through the media that terrorists blew up the Marine barracks. But what were the Marines doing there? That's not too much discussed. And also what's never referenced is the fact that the battleship New Jersey, which had the biggest guns of any ship in the world, frequently used those guns to lob huge shells, 2,000-pound shells, into the mountain region of Lebanon during this time, of the beginning of the Lebanese resistance that ended up 18 years later pushing the Israelis out, that would destroy an entire village. So there was that. And in 1983, there was Grenada. In 1989, there was the invasion of Panama. In 1992, Somalia. Beginning around 1995 with the bombing and then the war in 1999 against Yugoslavia. In 2001, Afghanistan. In 2003, Iraq. There were the wars that were mostly proxy wars, but still U.S. troops went into to El Salvador. I mean, and that doesn't count all the other CIA coups and interventions and proxy wars. And in none of these instances did the Congress act on those. I mean, maybe afterwards they questioned them. In a couple of cases, they cut off appropriations for a couple of years. But in general, and when they did, of course, what did the White House do when the aid was cut off to Nicaragua? Well, that's this Iran-Contra story. You know, they found a way to do it, to go around the Congress. When the genocide that was going on in Guatemala, and even Bill Clinton later said it was genocide against the Mayas, you know, it's kind of disgusting that now you have the Apocalypto movie from, you know, this anti-Semitic kind of madman, Gibson, coming out. You know, and this is the depiction people will get of the Maya people. And the Mayan people are very unhappy about it, because how about a movie about what happened to them? How about a popular movie about what happened to them because of the overthrow of their government, the Arbenz government, in 1954, and then, you know, 50 years or 40 years of genocidal war that killed 200,000 people. And when the Congress acted for a couple of years to cut off aid to Guatemala, the U.S. got the Israelis to come in. And they just funneled the money, and the Israeli trainers came in. And I believe to this day, if you want to see the standard rifle of the Guatemalan army, it's the Galil. It's an Israeli-made rifle. So there's all of this, and this doesn't mention also really what was the biggest war of all, which was really a 45-year war against the Soviet Union and its allies, a war that consumed just in the nuclear expenditures something like $7 or $8 trillion in expense. So what we see really is that the Congress has had not much to do with any of this. And the expectation, I think, now out of this election, if we look at the history in an objective way, and we look at the actions of the congressional leaders, now they've gotten back Congress for the first time since 1994, I think that's placing false hopes. And, I mean, it's particularly interesting that at the very beginning, they would surrender the one instrument that they would have, the main instrument for affecting policy. You know, it was interesting that, I don't know if any of you saw the press conference yesterday, Bush and Blair. Did anybody see that? And it was shown for quite a while on CNN. And one of the British reporters, who Bush later referred, he was, I think it was the reporter from BBC, Nick Robertson, who's like a senior correspondent, and guy in his mid-50s, who Bush later referred to as a lad, and said, that's what you call him over there, isn't it, lads? And all of the British press corps just kind of cracked up. And Blair said, I don't think anyone's called him a lad in quite some time. Blair isn't too, Bush isn't too quick on some of this stuff. But the reporter asked him, well, what about this? You know, if there's one thing we can say about the Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group report, which of course is timed with the election, and that's was to open the door for that. But they said, well, look, it says that all that you did, you know, this whole war has turned into, it's been a disaster. And what about accountability for the things that have happened? And his answer was, well, the thing I like about it is it looks to the future. Everyone should think about that one. It looks to the future. So, I mean, everyone who's charged with a criminal offense would like to be able to employ this as their defense. Let's not talk about the past. Let's just talk about the future, right? I mean, it's like, I mean, the fact that they let him off the hook on that one I thought was interesting. There is a changing of the guard that is taking place, though, and that is important. But it's not really, I believe that the emergence of the Baker-Hamilton group is connected with the election. And, of course, the firing of Rumsfeld the day after the election, 1 week after Bush said that Rumsfeld and Cheney would both be with him till the end of his term, is also connected with that. It can be a changing of the guard, but what is really changing? There were there's, you know, the idea that, well, Rumsfeld's out, so this has opened the door for something better. Well, who is Gates? Is the question that has to be asked. And one thing that was very interesting to me is I remember being involved in December 1984 in organizing emergency demonstrations around the United States because some of us believed that the United States was about to launch an all-out war against Nicaragua, this little country of 1.5 million people at that time that had had the temerity to have a revolution and was trying in one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere give people health care and education and a future, right? I don't know if people have seen the book by William Bloom that's called Killing Hope. If you haven't seen it, William Bloom, B-L-U-M, it's a very useful little book to get. And I'm not sure who Osama bin Laden referenced it in one of his tapes, and it shot up to being number one on the bestseller list in the United States. And they asked William Bloom, who I know in Washington, who's a very, you know, kind of scholarly guy, very nice guy. Well, don't you feel bad? Wolf Blitzer had him on. So don't you feel bad about, you know, bin Laden? And he said, no, it's great. I'm selling a lot more books now. But the book is interesting because I think it expresses what U.S. foreign policy has meant to so many people. And his book goes through country after country. There must be 40 or 50 countries in there. And one of them, of course, was Nicaragua. And I remember this in late November, right after the election, where Reagan had been reelected. And this is part of the reason we thought, well, they're going to go now. There's a good chance. And it just was revealed that last week that Gates, who was then deputy director of the CIA, had written a lengthy memo to Reagan saying, now is the time to go. Now is the time to bomb the ports, the major cities, the military facilities, the key economic facilities in Nicaragua, and take out the Sandinista government altogether. That's Gates. And if you look at, you know, that whole list that I just ran through, if you go back for like the last 30 years, Gates, who was a person who moved up the ladder until he became director of the CIA under Bush the First, In 1991 to 93, he participated in many of those, in many of these what are real atrocities, you know, of coups and interventions and really, you know, smashing the possibility for people in mostly what has been called the third world to try to emerge, to try to take control of their destiny, to try to take control of their resources. And instead of the resources going for United Fruit or Exxon or, you know, whoever else, but to use them for themselves, that was the point. And Gates has been a key player in all of that. Gates represents, though, a different strategic outlook on the Middle East, and he has for a long time. And part of it has to do with Iran. I mean, he has a different view about how to do this, about how they can accomplish what they want to do. And Gates was in the Baker-Hamilton group, the Iraq study group, until he was nominated. And then he resigned from the group, or when he knew that he was going to be nominated, came under consideration for it. But he himself was also really a follower, so to speak, of Baker. Baker was a key person. Baker is actually a bigger political power in the state of Texas than is Bush, the Bush family. The Baker he runs this huge law firm, and Baker was running foreign policy under the first Bush administration, and Baker was a realist, as they call him. It doesn't mean anything better. And I think this is the important thing to emphasize. And Gates was with him. Hamilton was one of these two. Hamilton was on the Democratic side. He was Lee Hamilton. He was a congressman from Indiana. He was the head of the House International Relations Committee up until the time that the Democrats lost control of the House in the 1994 election. And there's others too. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor. I mean, it's all the elite. It's a grouping of the elite, but with a different perspective than the neocon perspective. They're coming in and saying, "Okay, you have failed." To the neocons made certain promises that they would be able to do things. What did they promise that they would be able to do? They promised that the Iraq war would be a fast war, it would be a cheap war, it would be a war that required very limited number of troops, and that it would be welcomed by the people of Iraq. You remember the people who said, like Pearl and Wolfowitz and the others, you know, talked about how And General Franks, who was, you know, the commander of the U.S. operation there, and Franks said by the July or August, that's 2003, we'll be down to somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 30 to 40,000 troops, and it'll all be, and they had their vision, and they in controlling the reins of government and the reins of foreign policy, they promised these things, and they not only promised that they would be able to do this in Iraq, which was formerly the most powerful of the Arab countries, particularly in the Gulf, the key strategic Gulf region. But then they would be able to utilize what they did to Iraq to bring about change throughout the region. And on April 10th, John Bolton, April 9th, Baghdad fell, 2003. On April 10th, John Bolton made a speech, and it was interesting that he would be the one to make a speech because he was then the Undersecretary of State for Arms Limitations, meaning the arms limitations of countries the United States doesn't like, of course. Yeah. But Bolton made a public statement. He came out and made a statement to the press. He said, "Iran and North Korea and Syria should learn the lesson of Iraq." And the day after that, the U.S. ambassador to the Dominican Republic said, "Cuba should learn the lesson of Iraq," or heed the lesson. Those were the words that they used. And of course, all of those countries did. I mean, it was not the lesson that the United States intended them to learn. It was their interpretation. I mean, what the Bush administration was saying, what Bolton was saying, what these functionaries were saying, I think could be summarized as this. If you don't do what we want you to do, we'll bomb your country, we'll destroy your infrastructure, we'll blockade you for as long as we want to, maybe 13 years. We'll kill a million of your people, the very young and the very old, by doing this and knowing that we're doing it. We'll weaken your country, and if you still don't do what we want you to do, we'll invade you and we'll overthrow your government and we'll put and bring about regime change. And we'll destroy your status as an independent state, which is, of course, what happened to Iraq. I mean, I think that can be characterized as a terrorist threat. And but they said they would do it, and they said they would carry it on. And the lesson, of course, that the countries who were faced with this, it was, well, you either surrender your independence or get ready. That was their interpretation of it. That certainly is the interpretation of, on the part of North Korea. That's said by a number of U.S. diplomats, and probably all of the countries who are being targeted, who are being named, who are being called axis of evil. They didn't take it lightly when the President of the United States in a State of the Union message says these things. The thing is that from the point of view of those who are wielding power and who are in different factions themselves, the failure to be able to accomplish this is a serious offense. That's the problem from their point of view. If they had been able to do what they said they were going to do in Iraq, then, you know, it wouldn't have been the big issue of the 2006 election. That would have been over, and probably the war would have moved on to somewhere else. I believe that it was, there's no question that the Cheney, Wolfowitz, Bush, Rumsfeld, Rice grouping had that in mind. They said so. They said, they pretty much came right out and said it at times. But they did not, were not able to do it. And, you know, it's one of the things that I think is kind of interesting, I guess that's the word I'll use, in the Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group, is that if you, I have a copy of it here, you can, anyone can, you know, you can buy the book or download it or something. But if you look at the appendix, if you look at all the people that they talked to, they didn't talk to anybody from the anti-war perspective, who was from a real anti-war perspective. They didn't talk to anybody who said, like we said in March and April of 2003, that if they understand, and I remember saying this many, many times in at mass rallies and in speaking, all kinds of speaking engagements, that if anyone understands the history of Iraq, you will know that what is being predicted, the rose petals and chocolates that are going to be being thrown at the soldiers when they come in, you know, that that's a complete illusion. That the history of Iraq was from the time Iraq was taken over by the British, when the British had promised you know, independence for the Arab people, and instead they found themselves divided between the two great empires of the world at the time, the French and the British Empire. The resistance started in 1920. There was a rebellion in 1920. There was a rebellion in 1925. There was a rebellion in 1932, in 1936, in 1941, in 1946, in 1948, in 1952, in 1956, and finally the revolution in 1958. The rebellions lasted until the people were so exhausted that they couldn't continue, and then very soon afterwards, the rebellion against British occupation resumed. Against British occupation and against that thin layer of the population that the British supported and who enriched themselves as the junior partners. People like the Chalabi family, remember him, Ahmed Chalabi, owned 2 million acres of land. And this is at a time when Iraq owned 0% of its oil, when the living conditions, the literacy rates, the starvation, the lack of medical care was on the same level for the Iraqi people sitting on top of that giant pool of oil as it is in Afghanistan now. You know, so that, well, of course, none of us were interviewed by the Baker-Hamilton group. It's all within the club at the top. They represent a different point of view and have for a long time. It's interesting to remember in the first Gulf War when it ended. Remember all that hue and cry about, why didn't we go to Baghdad and finish the job? And what Baker said at the time, if I recall correctly, I believe it was Baker, and I think Bush said basically the same thing, because they were asked it in a lot of different settings. They said, in essence, this, well, that would be a way in which we could convert victory into defeat. Does that ring any bells about like what's going on? Of course they could go to Baghdad. They could have gone to Baghdad in 1991. The road was open. The Iraqi army had been crushed. This supposedly powerful force had no weaponry, really, to deal with the power that they were facing. And they could have gone to Baghdad. They could have been in Baghdad in 3 days, 2 days. But then they would have had to take over Baghdad and occupy Baghdad. And that's why they didn't do it at the time. So the Baker-Hamilton group has a different strategy. And I think there were many who at the time, and I think Powell, by the way, was part of that group. And then in the lead up to the war, he had to either resign from the government in 2002, or he had to take over selling the policy to the world. And he was a good person to do that, and he decided to do that. And he has to take the consequences for doing that. But the other grouping, and I think this was their view, was why do we have to do this? They were the minority voice. They were not running policy in 2002, 2003, the way they had been 12 years earlier. I think their view was, we're very strong in the Middle East right now. We've got Iraq in a very weakened position. We have our bases in Bahrain. You know, the Fifth Fleet is based there, in Qatar, where the Central Command is based. We have the bases in Kuwait. Kuwait is all, you know, Saudi Arabia. The bases in Turkey. We have Jordan is with us. We have Israel. You know, why do we have to do this? Why do we have to go for this all-out war against Iraq? And the other side said, no, this is it. This is the moment, the historic moment, when we will transform the entire region. And as their first step of transforming the entire region, they dissolved all the institutions of the Iraqi government, right? I mean, everything. The army, the police, the ministries, all of the... And those ministries in Iraq are much more important in the day-to-day lives of people in many countries than, say, the departments of the United States are. I mean, they distribute food. There was a food rationing program. They distribute oil. Gasoline and, you know, all kinds of things. All of that was wiped away. Chaos ensued. And their attempt to construct something new has turned into a complete and total disaster that no one can deny. Even Bush in his press conference yesterday when they asked him, you know, they said, you said it seems it's unsettling. And then, you know, and he said, they said to him, the Baker-Hamilton group says it's a complete disaster. You say it's unsettling. He said, okay, it's bad. It's bad in Iraq. Okay? Are you happy with that? It is bad. It's terrible. You know, it's the situation for the people there is so horrific. It's an act of almost unprecedented viciousness, what's been done, of a horror that's been imposed on the whole people. You know, I'm not a supporter of Saddam Hussein. I have a different political perspective. I know about a lot of the things that happened. This is not how life was. And the Iraqis all say so, too. I mean, last month in Baghdad, here's one of the most energy-rich countries in the whole world. The average length of time that households had electricity was 2.6 hours a day. That means for 21 hours and what is it? 2.4 hours a day. For 21 hours and 36 minutes out of the average day, you don't have electric power. I mean, it's just incredible what's happened. And the death rate, the death toll, they're lying about it. They're not telling the truth. It's much higher than what we're hearing. Just a couple days ago, there was a report coming out saying that, you know, in July, and one day in July when the Pentagon reported that there had been 93 violent incidences, there had been over 1,100. 1,100 in one day. The situation is a horrific situation, and the situation, though, is now virtually out of control, I would say. The U.S. has very little control outside of the green zone in the center of the city, which took over a lot of the best part of Baghdad. But outside of that, very little control, and very little is offered in the way of any of those who are making the... who are offering recommendations, the 79 recommendations of the Iraq Study Group and others. What is their real aim? Because I think they know how bad. If you read, how many people here have read any of this, the study group report? Has anybody read any of it? It's worth reading because not so much for what it projects, but its assessment of the situation. I mean, you cannot escape the overwhelming sense of how awful the situation is there now, and how they don't really have, they have constant qualifiers, even in their recommendations, that they don't know if this will really work. But basically what they're proposing is you have to end this ridiculous policy of saying everyone who was in the Ba'ath Party is the same as the Nazis or something like that. And that's kind of funny, too, because there was the very quick rehabilitation of most of the Nazis by the United States in West Germany. That it has to be, you have to be real. There were millions of people. This was the party that was running the country, and there has to be some reality about that. They want to find a compromise between different groups. They want to bring Iran and Syria into the process, hoping that, you know, they, because they share long borders, can help to stabilize the situation. But they're not very optimistic about doing it. The real point of it, I think, is to give some cover to try to have some way of withdrawing. But more than that, I mean, not a complete withdrawal, because there's no intention at all of leaving Iraq. None of the sides intend to leave. This is a great, valuable prize, and it will be a great, valuable prize as they see it for a long time to come. And there's also the other side of what this can mean, but which I just want to mention, but what they're really trying to do, and I would recommend to people, I also write for a website that's called pslweb.org, and there's a little card you can pick up on the table in the back, and it has a lot of good articles about this. What they're really trying to do is prevent this disastrous situation from turning into a complete catastrophe for U.S. policy in the Middle East. And there's a very good chance that it can. One of the things that they say, and I think is interesting, and it's interesting from the point of view also of the anti-war movement and the debates in the anti-war movement, to see this in writing from the Baker Hamilton group is, I thought I was drawn to, was that they say all the issues in the Middle East are inextricably linked. And the point here, of course, is that there's been a big debate. Should we only talk about Iraq, or do we have to talk also about what's going on with the Palestinians? Do we have to talk about what's also going on in Lebanon? Well, this is Baker and Hamilton, you know, from the ruling elite saying they're all inextricably linked, and if we can't solve them, you know, if we can't find some solutions elsewhere, we're not going to find a solution in Iraq either. It's interesting to recall also, and I won't go on too much longer, but interesting to recall that in 1991, as soon as the Iraq War ended, the first Iraq War, and also at the time when the Soviet Union was just collapsing, which had been the ally of a number of the Arab regimes, of the Arab countries, that Baker was propelled forward the Middle East peace process. Up until that time, the United States had never officially been willing to talk to the Palestinians, any of the Palestinian organizations. But now they wanted to do it, and they wanted to do it because he's had this view, you know, this view for a long time, that and understanding that the Bush administration has denied that they've never met, you know, until very recently, never met with any of the Palestinian leaders in the whole 6 years Bush has been in. Sharon was the person who came to the White House more than any other international leader of another country, times three. You know, and then, you know, you have Olmert coming all the time, too. Their idea was, no, we'll just stand with the Israelis. We'll just, you know, smash the Palestinians, too. We'll smash the Iraqis. We'll smash them all. You know, that was really their idea. Well, Baker, back in 91, as soon as the Gulf War ended, he started the process that first met in Madrid and then went on to become the Oslo Accord. And this is their view, that they have to find a solution. Now, their solution, I have to emphasize this, is not one of justice. They want pacification. They want peace in the region. But they want a Pax Americana. They want to settle everything down. But they have a view that you cannot settle everything down without talking to the people. And this is what they keep saying. When you keep hearing them say, we have to talk to our enemies, they've had a chance now. The neocons have had a chance for 4 years to demonstrate the smashing strategy. Just smash everybody you don't like. And it hasn't worked. In fact, not only has it not worked, what it has done is that it has damaged the standing of U.S. power in the region. Severely damaged it. You know, there's no draws in wars, really. Like you take the what happened with Israel and Lebanon this summer, that was a significant defeat for Israel. Israel is the superior military power. Israel wanted to bring, wanted to crush the resistance movements, including Hezbollah, not only Hezbollah, in Lebanon. They wanted to pacify the border. They wanted to bring about regime change. And it wasn't just Israel. In fact, the indications are, and we've written about this, that the idea for the war really came more from the United States than it did from the Israelis. And there's a lot of evidence about that. When the superior power does not achieve its objectives, it has lost. It has suffered a defeat. There are degrees of defeat. It's not like, you know, the government in Washington fell or something like that. But it was a defeat for them. What's going on in Iraq is a defeat. The big empires cannot stand defeat. If you remember the earlier times, like even, you know, here where there would be, or in all the empires, when there would be revolts of the slaves, they not only had to defeat the slaves, they had to go out into the countryside, into the mountains, they had to find their leaders, and they had to bring their heads back on pikes. That was the policy. And why was that? Because they had to demonstrate to those who would think about rebelling and revolting, this is what will happen to you if you stand against us, if you try to resist our agenda. This is what will happen. And that was the policy. And now what has happened in the Middle East is that the superior military powers, meaning the United States and Israel, have both suffered very significant setbacks. Israel has worked on the doctrine of the Iron Wall. The Iron Wall meaning that there must be no question that Israel is overwhelmingly superior to not just one, but all of the Arab countries and movements put together. That's the basis from which they want to negotiate, and only that basis. There's a big dent in the Iron Wall. There's a big dent in the U.S. Iron Wall, too. And what it's doing is it's encouraging others throughout this region, which is the most vital strategic region of the world, to think that they, too, can resist. And no one should have any question. The dissatisfaction throughout the region is at an extraordinarily high level. The anti-U.S. sentiment is at an unbelievably high level, and it's only held in check by a great deal of repression. I'm talking about in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Jordan. And one state in particular that they're worried about, very worried about, is Jordan. And why are they worried about Jordan? Jordan is kind of an artificial country. It was created by the British. It has a very strong police state to keep down repression, and a lot of repression goes on. But it's not a very strong, it's a brittle state. So very interesting that in the last month, Rice has been to Jordan. Jordan's a small country. Rice has been there. Cheney's been there. Bush has been there. Why are they all rushing off to Jordan? Well, they're worried, and they're extremely worried about what's going on in Lebanon right now. Extremely. Everything has lined up in Lebanon. All the forces are lined up. The internal forces are lined up. You have, on the one side, the Hezbollah. You have the Free Patriotic Movement, which commands the allegiance, surprisingly, of a large part of the Maronite Christian community, the Lebanese Communist Party, the Amal, which is another basically Shiite movement, and some Sunni movements. And on the other side, this government of Senora, of Fouad Senora, and who really supported by the old elites, most of the old elites. But behind them on each side, and I think the only reason the Senora government isn't gone yet, and it may be gone soon, but after this week of unprecedented protest and camping, is that behind the Senora government is the U.S. and France and Italy and Germany and Britain and Israel and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Jordan, and also Mahmoud Abbas. The president of the Palestinian Authority has taken that side. The vast majority of the Palestinians are on the other side. Behind that, the other side in Lebanon, are those resistance movements in Palestine, Iran and Syria, and really public opinion. And I wrote an article just last night that is on this website that I mentioned about the situation in Lebanon right now. And the way that that goes can have a profound shift, a change in the region. And it's interesting that here we are in 2006. This is 1958 was when I mentioned the U.S. Marines went into Lebanon after the Iraqi Revolution. and fearing that if Lebanon and Jordan, either one of them went, the governments went, that the whole region, the status quo could end in the whole region. Well, now we're in a different period. The U.S. policy was to crush all the secular forces, the nationalists, the communists, the socialists, the Nasserists, you know, all over the region. And so now it's the Islamic forces that are leading. And that's a large part of the reason why. But it's a somewhat analogous situation in that if this were to happen, if the government falls in Lebanon, then they have a whole other problem. There's a whole other problem. And this is, I would say, a very critical moment. As far as the anti-war movement goes, just to end on this note, and just to say that one other thing about Lebanon is that there is dual power in Lebanon. The idea of dual power. There is not one power. There are two power. There are two contending centers of power, which is an inherently unstable situation and cannot last for too long a time. I mean, there may be a compromise for a period of time. I'm not predicting what the outcome will be. But there's really not one center of power. The government is not the only center of power in the country. So as far as the anti-war movement, I think that a starting point just looking at it is this, is that the hopes of so many people that were expressed by the vote on November 7th cannot be achieved, cannot come to fruition through the electoral process or through Congress. I would say that categorically. That's not going to happen unless and until there's something else that happens. And that is the rise of an independent power. There needs to be a new power that's created inside the United States. The elements, that it's there in an embryonic stage. You know, a lot of people say, well, look at the Gulf War, and look, I mean, the 2002, 2003 war. Look at all those hundreds of thousands of people marched, and we couldn't stop the war, so the movement failed. I think that's a limited understanding. It took 10 years from the first big anti-war demonstration in Vietnam for the war to end. It's very hard to stop wars. It's very hard to stop the ship of state when it's, you know, sailing in a particular direction. But I know this from having the opportunity to go around the country, to go a lot of places, a lot of small towns as well as bigger cities, that outcome of that movement was that in every city and town in the United States, virtually every single one, even very small towns, there are political activists and there is a political movement and it's there. And it's the size of the demonstrations is not something in our power. It's something that, you know, it comes about because of the political conditions and the mood of people and so forth. But all over the country there is. That power, that incipient power, it needs to be developed. And I think if you look objectively at the history of the last 100 years in the United States, that when we go forward as a people, it doesn't begin in the halls of Congress or the White House. It begins in the streets. It begins in the workplaces. It begins in the communities. It begins in the campuses. And a movement comes into being, and that movement forces change. And that's the only way it's happened. If you look at the labor movement of the 1930s, you know, and the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the women's movement, the lesbian and gay movement, the environmental movement, all of those movements, when they first arise, are treated by the political establishment as pariahs, right? Oh, you know. And they all say, we don't listen to that. And the president says, we don't pay any attention to those demonstrations. I don't know if you remember Nixon. Nixon was never paid any attention to the anti-war demonstrations. He was watching football in the White House when 800,000 people were outside. Then you read the biographies and the memoirs later and learned that he was in there drinking and, you know, why do they hate me? And then stumbling out to the Lincoln Memorial and saying to the kids, how's your football team doing? I mean, I like football okay, but I remember at that time that if anybody had asked me how, like, you know, a sports team was doing in the midst of the Vietnam War, you know, so he got the response that he deserved. But they all pretend this, that they don't care, until the moment when they're forced to concede. Until the moment that they're forced to concede, they pretend that the movement means nothing to them. And then, of course, it's, we did it. Right? And then they want to claim credit for it. It's like, you know, you would never know that Reagan and all those people around Reagan resisted until 1986. They were big supporters of apartheid in South Africa. But it goes right down the line. What moves us forward, what can move us forward, and what I would argue is the only thing that can move us forward is creating and building a new people's movement in this country that's not just against war, but opposes, you know, many of the things that I think are, you know, are really bringing the average person down. This maximization of profit is the only moral standard, you know, that you can't mess with that. And if you have to cut down all the trees at once, well, fine, cut down all the trees at once. Suck up everything out of the ocean. There's a multi-layered crisis, and what we are trying to do as the Answer Coalition is to build the links with the labor movement that's been so besieged, with the civil rights movement, with the environmental movement, with all of the movements that are fighting for the people, because all of this is indissolubly connected to each other. The fact that they can spend $320 million a day on the Iraq war, which is only one-fifth of the military budget, and at the same time they can come forward as they did this spring in their budget proposal and say they wanted to eliminate the senior nutrition program that provided 565,000 seniors with bulk food, which isn't very good, but it's the difference between, for that grouping in the population, between eating and not eating. And it's a program that costs $120 million over 5 years. I mean, that says something. That was defeated, by the way, by people who were involved in that. But I think you see what I mean. I mean, what we really believe, what we are dedicated to as the Answer Coalition, is building that movement which can change the course, which can change history. Thanks.